Hey, how's it going? This is Chad Haig reporting from Southern India. I'd like to start a series of videos for patrons only. This will not be publicly available on YouTube. Only you guys, the patrons, have access to it, and it will be a higher quality of video than what you find on YouTube. I put more time and effort into these videos for you guys because we are trying to provide an alternative to the university model of education. Now, just very quickly, we have this bizarre situation where it's more expensive than ever before to attend college, $40,000, $50,000, $70,000 a year. And you're learning less than ever before. My last interview to teach as an adjunct, they just flat out said in the interview, we don't teach content anymore. That's an outdated view of education. It's pointless to even try to get people to learn anything. They should just come here and pick up life skills. You know, they should do group PowerPoint presentations and other frustrating bullshit like that and end up $100,000 in debt. It's a great deal, isn't it? Well, we can do better than that. University at this point is just a front operation for student loans. We can, in this venue, have a more rigorous education than your top PhD program in America, but for you guys at a cost of just a few dollars a month, virtually free by American standards. And we're going to start now with a detailed reading of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. This was the text that you guys chose in a poll of different options as where you wanted to begin. And this is great because I think this is one of the foundational texts of Western philosophy. I don't think it's possible to really understand Western philosophy since the early 19th century without at least some familiarity with this book. And it's a great read once you know how to read it, but it is, of course, a legendarily difficult text. Some have jokingly called it an ornamental text, which is meant to sit on your shelf, not to be read. But I'll show you in this series of videos that it is, in fact, possible to read this text and get a lot out of it. But first, we need to talk about dialectic. If you went to university and paid $50,000 a year to learn from a professor, you probably just got the SparkNotes version of Hegel, which is thesis, antithesis, synthesis. There's three different concepts. You have an apparent contradiction, and then you have a nice mixture that balances the best of both worlds, is the SparkNotes version. Well, that is quite inadequate to Hegel, because what's going on with Hegel is something a good deal more sophisticated than that caricature. But first we have to talk about what the traditional view of truth before Hegel was, and that is the correspondence theory of truth, which is basically that truth is scientific description. Okay, so in the ancient view, there's a dualism between the human mind and a fact, and if the two are in accord, then you have truth. Okay. In the medieval view, this becomes the accord between the mind of man and the mind of God, because God knows everything. Man can only be correct if his mind is in accord with God's mind. In analytical philosophy, this becomes the project of having a logical proposition accord with a scientific fact in the world. However, Hegel does away with the dualistic model altogether by showing that you can have an understanding of truth based on immanent critique. For him, there's no need to go beyond the notion to examine the outside. You must instead see whether the notion is living up to its own criteria. Now that probably sounds a little bit obscure, but we think this way when we talk about the difference between true gold and fool's gold. Fool's gold is not gold at all. It has failed to be what it was supposed to be. And for Hegel, this is the model of truth itself. Truth is the embodiment of the notion. The problem, of course, is that Hegel's entire body of work is about how this kind of doesn't happen. When you actually do succeed in embodying the notion itself just changes. So you have all of these phases of art in which you're trying to provide representation for the absolute within things like sculpture, etc. And when you actually get an understanding of what you were trying to do, you're no longer art. Now you're just religion. But of course, religion deals with the absolute in a different way. That's why it's no longer art. Religion, however, also runs into these problems of embodying the notion, which when they're resolved, it's no longer religion. Now it's just philosophy. Now you're dealing with the absolute in a totally different way. That's why it's not religion and it's not art. So negation has a very strange role for Hegel. It's good because it moves dialectic forward, and yet it's something which is also, by some interpretations, unavoidable. So Žižek's reading of Hegel, for example, is simply that when you have Hegelian resolution, you're not restoring positivity that you temporarily lost when you had negation. You're reconciling with negation itself. But of course, that's a whole nother video, and we will go there. But for now, we're going to talk about the status of negation itself. Most people, when they think of negation, they really just are thinking of abstract negation, which is no without any further qualification. Hegel said that is a legitimate instance of a certain type of negation, but there's also determinate negation, which is no with content. And the term Aufhebung is nearly impossible to translate into English with just one word, because when Hegel uses it, he means three meanings which Heidegger noted in his own lectures on phenomenology of spirit. You can describe with three Latin terms what is captured within this one German term on its own. First one is tollere, which in Latin is to remove or to eliminate. This sort of sense of you are negating it and eliminating it, but you also have conservare, which is to preserve. And you also have elevare, which is to lift up to a higher level of knowing itself and its known. Dialectic is negation, but it's also preservation, but it's also elevation all at once. The higher phases contain their predecessors, but that is precisely through, in a certain sense, eliminating them. And you can see this map of Hegel's thought in the encyclopedia on the screen, where you start with being, nothing, becoming, and you go through so many other phases, which should really be thought of as an evolution, as unpopular such a term has become in postmodernism. And therefore, if we focus rather today on phenomenology of spirit, you could see the following evolution, in which the phases of phenomenology of spirit roughly go, you know, consciousness is trying to define truth as a thing. This is trying to get the consciousness of the object right. You think at first it's sense certainty, then you think it's the perception of a thing with properties. More sophisticated still is the understanding of a scientific force and its laws, like, say, Isaac Newton. And when you actually get consciousness right, you only do so because now it becomes self-consciousness. And self-consciousness defines the truth as the self. But of course, when that has its own problems, which when you basically get self-consciousness right, now it's reason, which is unity of self and thing. Descartes' revolution is the individual cogito, which can think the universal truth of mathematics, etc. But of course, reason has its own problems, which when you basically get it right, now it's spirit, which is truth as a world. This is all about things like community, etc., rather than just the individual thinker, right? And when you finally get community right, now it's just religion, which is a rather different type, maybe, of community. But here, truth is the unity of man and God, and that problematizes things to the point where when you sort of get religion right, you overcome the understanding of the absolute in what Hegel calls picture terms. You think of it as some external thing. When you realize that the absolute, it must be understood dialectically, that's when you find truth as the unity of man and God, time and eternity, but rendered conceptually as a science. And we will work our way through all of these phases, but we begin today with consciousness and sense certainty. Now, this is logically the first and the most basic mode of knowing, in which this is really just the hope of an immediate intuition. An immediate intuition is one without mediation, without universality, without notion, right? And that cannot be anything except an intuition of this. This is not a whole with parts. This is not a thing with attributes. It is radically particular. And although it seems to be the richest knowledge, after all, without any notional mediation to interfere with that it, as it is in itself, experiences contents of this phase seem to be infinitely detailed. And yet, the question whether sense certainty is the truest knowledge, precisely because it seems to be pure Sein, pure being, without any further qualification or mediation, is the question indirectly whether non-discursive truth is possible, or whether non-discursive truth, especially by Hegel's standard, is itself a contradiction in terms. And the dream of a knowledge without mediation, the dream of knowing a pure this, is something you find within the quotes I would recommend you to locate within your own copy of the text on the screen, in which he basically shows that what appears to be the richest knowledge is actually the most impoverished, because basically all you're left with is being. And yet this being, rather than being a plentitude, is actually an emptiness in itself. It's actually, in a certain sense, much like he says at the beginning of the Logic, a being which is nothing. Okay, and because all you can say about it is that it is, or the bare fact of its being, you have a failure already on a dialectical level to embody the notion, which leads this to break up into two thises. So, you know, you're trying to start with this, but there's an ambiguity there, because there's the subjective this, which is the I, and but there's also the objective this, which is the object under investigation. And what happens is you have a dialectic of sense certainty, where in the first stage you posit that object as essential. This logically corresponds to the in itself phase. In the second stage, you posit the subject as essential. This is the for itself phase. As a third stage, the subject and object are both considered essential. This is when you reach a point of being in and for itself. And this is basically just a gradual shift from the dream of radical particularity to having to deal with the problem of universality, whether you want to or not. Now, in the first stage, in which the object is essential, which is exemplified by quotes like the one you see on the screen, which I'd recommend you to locate within your own copy of the text, you are forced to confront the challenges of defining this in immediacy. And what you find is that spatially, if it's immediate knowledge, it's just here. Okay. Temporally, if it really is immediate, it's just now. And more specifically, they're here and now without any relation or mediation. In fact, he goes as far as to say that in this level, the I does not even think. Okay. However, language inevitably complicates even these efforts. For example, if we write down this truth, we find ourselves contradicted not that much later. For example, now might be night. But if we test the truth of this certainty of sense, a simple experiment, he says, is all we need. Just write that truth down. If it really is true, a truth cannot lose anything by being written down, just as little by our preserving and keeping it. But if we look at that truth again a little later, now it's noon, and we find the truth itself has turned stale. It has become out of date. Truth itself, however, is not supposed to go bad behind our backs. That's not the kind of truth we were bargaining for when we opened this. However, the very idea that now is supposed to be radically particular is contradicted by the fact that we actually have two different particulars. Night and day are both particulars, and they're both nows. Or, if you just explicitly emphasize the negativity of it, this proves that what we are dealing with is something, it proves to be rather a something which is not, excuse me. So, therefore, you have to talk about Hegel in comparison with Plato explicitly, in that that which exceeds any one of its embodiments in particular simply is the universal itself. Hegel says the self-maintaining now is therefore already not something immediate, but rather something mediated. Now, if you go back to ancient Greek tradition, Plato and Euclid both understood a circle as something different from any drawing of it. You can draw a circle on the ground, on a piece of paper, on a computer screen, but none of those are actually the eternal or abstract circle as such. You have to actually go to the realm of ideas to find that. However, Hegel mentions something about this tendency for a universal to exceed any instantiation of it, which Plato missed. The universal does this because it is in itself negative. The whole point of sense certainty, however, focusing on this without negation, without mediation, misses the point that this is not a this. Hegel says himself, a simple entity of this sort, which is by and through negation, which is neither this nor that, which is a not this, and with equal indifference as well as that, a thing of this kind is a universal, because each immediate now instantly vanishes. The enduring now cannot be anything except a mediated universal. And therefore, Hegel really finds that language is what complicates the dream of immediate knowledge without negation. When we use the word this, for example, we might subjectively mean a particular this, but what we actually say is just the universal this. In German, Hegel relies on a play on words, which we don't have in English, but I can still try to show you. The word meinen is to mean, but the word mein is, just as in English, mine. So I mean what is mine, but I say what is the universal. So we don't actually and absolutely say, as I quote him himself, what in this sense certainly we really mean. Language, as we see, is the more truthful even than our own intentions. In it, we ourselves refute directly and at once our own meaning. And since universality is the real truth of sense certainty, and language merely expresses this truth, it's not possible at all for us to even express in words any serious, extremely sensuous existence which we mean. So you find the same problem with the word here. At one moment, here is a tree. Turn around, however, now here is a house. This is only seemingly problematic, however. Hegel says himself, the here itself doesn't disappear. It is and remains in the disappearance even of the house, tree, and so on, because it is indifferently house, tree, or any other thing. It was precisely because we wanted here to be some sort of a content, especially an absolute content, that we missed the point. Here is indifferent to content because it is a universal in itself. Therefore, the failure to embody the notion there leads to the second phase of the dialectic of sense certainty, which is now the subject is essential. This is the phase which is for itself. Things turned out to be, as Hegel says himself, just the reverse of what first appeared. The object which professed to be the essential reality is now the non-essential element of sense certainty. The universal which the object has come to be is no longer such as the object essentially was to be for sense certainty. The certainty is now found to lie in the opposite element, namely in knowledge, which formerly was the non-essential factor. Its truth lies in the object as my or meinem object, or lies in the meaning, meinen, in what I mean. It is because I know it. Sense certainty is thus indeed banished from the object, but it is not yet thereby done away with altogether. It was merely forced back into the I. We have still to see what experience reveals regarding its reality in this sense, however. So in the second stage, where the subject is now essential, like these failures, we shift to focusing on knowing itself rather than just on the here, the now, etc. An object, of course, is not absolute content. An object is simply my posited object, which I have posited myself. Proof of this is that objects change. But no matter how many they do, many changes they undergo, my subjectivity is a constant, which remains amidst any of them. He says himself, the disappearance of the particular now and here that we mean is prevented by the fact that I keep hold on them. My subject, by the way, Hegel does not mean the biographical I of, like, endurance on an empirical level. He means the radically, purely particular I of right now, okay? And this inevitably leads to problems reminiscent of the ones we just dealt with. For example, is there a different I for each moment? If it's supposed to be as radically particular as here, now, etc., or this, if it is this I, is there a different one? Or is there an enduring I? How can we compare the different states, however, which even that enduring I shuffles through over time? What about the other I's in the literal sense of there are other people who also use the pronoun I to refer to themselves and to refer to their experiences? And therefore, language is once again complicating things. He says himself, another I, however, sees a house and maintains that here is not a tree, but a house. Both truths have the same authenticity. The immediacy of seeing and the certainty and assurance both have as to their specific way of knowing, but the one certainty certainly does disappear in the other. The I suffers the same fate as this. It's not, in fact, the immediate I of now, rather the word itself is universal. When I say I, this could be any I whatsoever. In fact, it could even be you, which is the exact opposite of what I meant. Therefore, once again, language, as I said, is what brings mediation into what appears to be immediacy. By saying this here, this now, an individual thing, I say all this is, all here's, all now's, all individuals. In the same way, when I say I, this individual, I say quite generally all I's, every I, and this individual I. Therefore, we move on to the third stage of the dialectic of sense certainty, in which the subject and object are both essential. This is the phase where we're in and for itself. We realize that it's neither the subject nor the object as such. It's the experience itself, which is the home of sense certainty. Sense certainty discovers by experience that its essential nature lies neither in the object nor the I, and that the immediacy peculiar to it is neither an immediacy of one nor the other. He says himself, we arrive in this way at the result, that we have to put the whole of sense certainty as its essential reality, and no longer merely one of its moments, as happened in both cases, where first the object is against the I, and then the I was to be its true reality. No longer subject or object. Now we're talking about an experience as such. Okay. He says, I'm directly conscious, I intuit and nothing more, I am pure intuition, I am now seeing, I am looking, okay, rather than just subject. Now you posit the whole relation of sense certainty as its essence. You move from the dream of a content to rather explicitly talking of a relation. And yet even the formula, excuse me, I plus A, is going to be problematized. In that what you really mean here is not so much a comparison of here and now themselves with one another, but rather the attempt to stick firmly to one immediate relation. And this sort of experience you're looking for, Hegel says, is really, you're just talking about pointing. Okay, and this is why this section is called the dialectic of pointing. We will go to it and let ourselves point out the now that is asserted. We must let ourselves point it out, for the truth of this immediate relation is the truth of this ego, which restricts itself to a now or a here. No longer are we dealing with comparisons. Each now is in itself already relation, but not compared to others. Not now and then, but a relation where we are able to talk about now, now, now. And the problem with pointing as an attempt to replace language is that it still fails to indicate the pure presence of relation. And this is actually because of time. When I point at it, it's already past. The now is pointed out as this now. It has already, however, ceased to be by the time it's pointed out. This is a very definition of it, by the way. The now is just this, to no longer be the very time when it is. He says himself, we have therefore to enter the same point of time or of space to indicate them, to point them out to ourselves. And we therefore can only hope to let ourselves take the place of the very same I, which is problematizing this. But in rejecting time, in its attempts to do so anyway, this section simply reveals time to be a process. He says himself, the very act of pointing out proves to be not immediate knowledge, but rather a process, a movement, a more sophisticated thing that you're dealing with than the kind of immediate content you were searching for at the very beginning of the book. He says himself, the now and pointing out the now are thus so constituted that neither the one nor the other is an immediate simple fact, but rather a process which contains diverse moments within it. Transition, by the way, in a temporal level, is not comparison, as we were dealing with earlier. Transition arises within the immediate relation in itself, and is therefore logically more sophisticated than the crude ideas which open the text. Likewise, we can get a sense of Hegel's view of sublation here. Now and what has been, or in other words, what is not now, is something which you can only understand if you find that the new now is an abiding universality rather than a particular immediacy. And this, my friends, we can only understand with dialectic. Hegel says himself, the dialectic process involved in sense certainty is nothing else than the mere history of its process, of its experience. And sense certainty itself is nothing else than simply this history. What does this mean for sense certainty itself, however? Do we come to doubt not only the senses, but even fall into a nihilism in which he himself brings about the nothingness of the things he's trying to understand, but also brings about, but partly he sees that these also bring about their own nothingness. And this wisdom about the nothingness of the world itself as the outcome of radicalizing sense certainty is something which he claims even animals, who seem to be, quite frankly, beings who are immersed in sense certainty without notional thinking, that's how they seem anyway, they're precisely the ones who realize this on a philosophical level, for they do not stand stock still before the things of sense as if these were things per se with being in themselves. They despair of this reality altogether, and in complete assurance of the nothingness of the things, they fall to without more ado and just eat them up. So you think that's a great philosophical treatise? No, to a goat that's lunch, and he'll eat it up right in front of you. The problem, once again, however, actually is language. He says, they speak of the existence of external objects. They mean this bit of paper I'm writing on, or rather that I have written on. But they do not say what they mean, because the this of sense which is meant cannot be reached by language, which belongs to consciousness, to what is inherently universal. So even the dream of finding the right words to talk about that dream of immediacy is impossible. So you're using language, you're already in the realm of universality, mediation, and most crucially, negation. I only get it right when I realize that when I point it out as a here, which is a here of other heres, or is in itself simply many heres together, it's already a universal. I take it up then as truth, as it is, and instead of knowing something immediate, I take something truly. This is a play on words in German. I take it truly means I perceive it. The German rendering of Wahrnehme is something which you can't actually put into English except by simply showing it in the original, because talking about perception as the truth of sense certainty gives us a view of Hegel's general view of dialectic. He says explicitly at the end of this section, it's only when I realize that I'm actually talking about perception that I get the experience of what is, in point of fact, the real truth of sense certainty. In other words, when I really understand what sense certainty is, it's no longer sense certainty, now it's just perception. And the next section, we will focus on the resources you get if you just make this shift to no longer searching for a radical particular like this here now, but rather explicitly talking about these are objects, these are things, I should say, with properties. And the idea of a single particular thing which has properties which are universal is of course going to cause its own problems. But if you remember what I said about when art gets it right, it becomes religion. When religion gets it right, it becomes philosophy. You see the same thing in Hegel, even within these individual like subsections. When you get sense perception right, it in a certain sense disappears because it becomes perception, and yet that is something which is inclusive of those. It preserves as it negates, but also elevates. So thank you so much, and I look forward to the next video, which will be done very soon.